Africa rose from the sea, with tantalizing deliberation, and then almost shyly swathed herself in the velvet robes of night and retreated once more from their gaze. The raft trundled on gently through the hours of darkness, and neither of them slept. Then the eastern sky began to soften and glow with the dawn. The stars paled out, and there close before them rose the great purple dunes of the Namibian desert.
"How beautiful it is," Santerne breathed.
"It's a hard, fierce land, miss," Ernie cautioned her.
"But it's so beautiful."
The dunes were sculptured in mauve and violet, and when the first rays of the sun touched the crests, they burned red gold and bronze.
"Beauty is as beauty does," mumbled Ernie. "Give me the green fields of old Blighty and bag the rest, begging your pardon, Miss Sunshine."
The yellow-throated gannets came out in long formations from the land, flying high enough to be gilded by the sunlight, and the surf upon the beaches sighed and rumbled like the breathing of the sleeping continent. The wind that had stood steadily behind them for so long now felt the land and eddied and twisted. It caught their tiny sail aback, and the mast collapsed and fell overboard in a tangle of canvas and ropes. They stared at each other in dismay. The land was so very close, it seemed that they might reach out and touch it. And yet they were forced to go through the whole weary business of re-stepping the mast. Neither of them had the energy for this new endeavour. Ernie roused himself at last, wordlessly untied the lanyard of the clasp-knife and handed it to Santerne. She fastened it around her own waist as the old man slid over the side of the raft once again and paddled to the peak of the stubby mast. On her knees, Santerne began to untangle the sheets and lines. The knots had all swollen with moisture, and she had to use the spike of the clasp-knife to break them open. She coiled the ropes and looked up as Ernie called,
"Are you ready, love?"
"Ready."
She stood and balanced uncertainly on the tossing raft with the guide rope from the top of the mast in her hands, taking up the slack, ready to assist Ernie to raise it back into position. Then something moved beyond the old man's bobbing head, and she froze and lifted her hand to shade her eyes. She puzzled over the strangely shaped object. It rode high on the green current, as high as a man's waist, and the early morning sun glinted upon it like metal. No, not metal, but like a lustrous dark velvet. It was shaped like the sail of a child's yacht, and with a nostalgic pang she remembered the little boys around the village pond on a Sunday afternoon, dressed in their sailor suits, sailing their boats.
"What is it, love?"
Ernie had seen her expectant pose and her puzzled expression.
"I don't know," she pointed. "Something strange, coming towards us fast, very fast."
Ernie swiveled his head.
"Where? I don't see—"
At that moment, a swell lifted the raft high.
"God help us!"
screamed Ernie, and flailed the water with his arms, tearing at it in an ungainly frenzy, as he tried to reach the raft.
"What is it? Help me out!"
Ernie gulped, smothering in his own wild spray.
"It's a bloody great shark!"
The word paralysed Santerne. She stared in stony horror at the beast, as another swell lifted it high, and the angle of the sunlight changed to pierce the surface and spotlight it. The shark was a lovely, slaty blue colour, dappled by the rippling surface shadows, and it was immense, much longer than their tiny raft, wider across the back than one of the hogsheads of cognac from the estate at Mortomme. The double-bladed tail slashed as it drove forward, irresistibly attracted by the wild struggles of the man in the water, and it surged down the face of the swell. Santerne screamed and recoiled. The shark's eyes were a cat-like golden colour, with black, spade-shaped pupils. She saw the nostril slits in its massive, pointed snout.
"Help me!"
screamed Ernie. He had reached the edge of the raft and was trying to drag himself on board. He was kicking up a froth of water, and the raft rocked wildly and listed towards him. Santin dropped to her knees and grabbed his wrist. She leaned back and pulled with all the strength of her terror, and Ernie slid halfway up on the raft, but his legs still dangled over the side. The shark seemed to hump out of the water. Its back rose glistening blue, streaming with seawater, and the tail fin stood up like an executioner's blade. Santin had read somewhere that a shark rolled on its back to attack, so she was unprepared for what happened now. The great shark reared back, and the grinning slit of its mouth seemed to bulge open. The lines of porcelain white fangs, rank upon rank of them, came erect like the quills of a porcupine as the jaws projected outwards, and then they closed over Ernie's kicking legs. She clearly heard the grating rasp of the serrated edges of its fangs on bone. Then the shark slid back, and Ernie was jerked backwards with it. Santin kept her grip on his wrist, although she was pulled down onto her knees and started to slide across the wet deck. The raft listed over steeply under their combined weight and the heavy drag of the shark on Ernie's legs. Santin could see its head under the surface for an instant. Its eye stared back at her with a fathomless savagery, and then the inner nictitating membrane slid across it in a sardonic wink, and quite slowly the shark rolled in the water with the irresistible weight of a teak log, exerting a shearing strain onto the jaws still clamped over Ernie's legs. Santin heard the bones part with a sound like breaking green sticks. The drag on the old man's body was released so suddenly that the raft bobbed up and swung like a crazy pendulum in the opposite direction. Santin, still with her grip on Ernie's arm, fell backwards, dragging him up on the raft after her. He was still kicking, but both his legs were grotesquely foreshortened, taken off a few inches below the knee, the stumps protruding from the torn cuffs of his duck trousers. The cuts were not clean. Dangling ribbons of torn meat and skin flapped from the stumps as Ernie kicked, and the blood was a bright fountain in the sunlight. He rolled over and sat up on the pitching raft and stared at his stumps.
"Oh, merciful mother, help me,"
he moaned.
"I'm a dead man."
Blood spurted from the open arteries, dribbled and ran in rivulets across the white deck, cascaded to the surface of the sea and stained it cloudy brown. The blood looked like smoke in the water.
"My legs!"
Ernie clutched at his wounds and the blood fountained up between his fingers.
"My legs are gone. The devil has taken my legs."
There was a huge swirl almost under the raft, and the dark triangular fin came up and knifed the surface, cutting through the discoloured water.
"He smells the blood," Ernie cried. "He won't give up, the devil. We're all dead men."
The shark turned, rolling on his side. So they saw his snowy belly and the wide grinning jaws, and he came back sliding through the bright clear water with majestic sweeps of his tail. He thrust his head into the blood clouds, and the wide jaws opened as he gulped at the taste. The scent and the taste infuriated him, and he turned again. The waters roiled and churned at the massive movement below the surface, and this time he drove straight under the raft. There was a crash as the shark struck the underside of the raft with his back, and Santin was thrown flat with the force of the impact. She clung to the raft with clawed fingers.
"He's trying to capsize us," shouted Ernie.
Santin had never seen so much blood. She could not believe that the thin, ancient body held so much, and still it spurted from Ernie's severed stumps. The shark turned and came back, again the heavy crash of rubbery flesh into the timbers of the raft, and they were lifted high. The raft hovered on the edge of capsizing and then fell back onto an even keel and bobbed like a cork.
"He won't give up," Ernie was sobbing weakly. "Here he comes again."
The shark's great blue head rose out of the water. The jaws opened and then closed on the side of the raft. Long white fangs locked into the timber, and it crunched and splintered as the shark hung on. It seemed to be staring directly at Son Tan as she lay on her belly, clinging to the struts of the raft with both hands. It looked like a monstrous blue hog, snuffling and rooting at the frail timbers of the little raft. Once again it blinked its eyes, the pale translucent membrane slipping over inscrutable black pupils was the most obscene and terrifying thing Son Tan had ever seen, and then it began to shake its head, still gripping the side of the raft in its jaws. They were thrown about roughly as the raft was lifted out of the water and swung from side to side.
"Good Christ, he'll have us yet!"
Ernie dragged himself away from the grinning head.
"He'll never stop till he gets us!"
Son Tan leapt to her feet, balancing like an acrobat, and she seized the thick wooden tiller and swung it high overhead. With all her strength, she brought it down on the tip of the shark's hog-like snout. The blow jarred her arms to the shoulders, and she swung again and then again. The tiller landed with a rubbery thump, then bounced off the great head without even marking the sandpapery blue hide, and the shark seemed not to feel it. He went on worrying the side of the raft, rocking it wildly. And Son Tan lost her balance and fell half overboard. But instantly she dragged herself back and on her knees kept beating the huge, invulnerable head, sobbing with the effort of each stroke. A section of the woodwork tore away in the shark's jaws, and the blue head slipped below the surface again, giving Son Tan a moment's respite.
"He's coming back,"
Ernie cried weakly.
"He will keep coming back. He won't give up."
And as he said it, Son Tan knew what she had to do. She couldn't allow herself to think about it. She had to do it for the baby's sake. That was all that counted. Michael's son. Ernie was sitting flat on the edge of the raft, those fearfully mutilated limbs thrust out in front of him, turned half away from Son Tan, leaning forward to peer down into the green waters below the raft.
"Here he comes again!"
he shrieked. His sparse grey hairs were slicked down on his pate by seawater and diluted blood. His scalp gleamed palely through this thin covering. Beneath them the waters roiled as the shark turned to attack once more, and Son Tan saw the dark bulk of him coming up from the depths, driving back at the raft. Son Tan came to her feet again. Her expression was stricken, her eyes filled with horror, and she tightened her grip on the heavy wooden tiller. The shark crashed into the bottom of the raft, and Son Tan reeled, almost fell, then caught her balance.
"He said himself he was a dead man," she steeled herself.
She lifted the tiller high and fixed her gaze on the naked pink patch at the back of Ernie's head, and then, with all her strength, she swung the tiller down in an axe stroke. She saw Ernie's skull collapse under the blow.
"Forgive me, Ernie,"
she sobbed, as the old man fell forward and rolled to the edge of the raft.
"You are dead already, and there was no other way to save my baby."
The back of his skull was crushed in, but he rolled his head and looked at her. His eyes were afire with some turbulent emotion, and he tried to speak. His mouth opened, then the fire in his eyes died, and his limbs stretched and relaxed. Son Tan was weeping as she knelt beside him.
"God forgive me," she whispered, "but my baby must live."
The shark turned and came back, its dorsal fin standing higher than the deck of the raft, and gently, almost tenderly, Son Tan rolled Ernie's body over the side. The shark whirled. It picked up the body in its jaws and began to worry it like a mastiff with a bone. And as it did so, the raft drifted away. The shark and its victim sank gradually out of sight into the green waters, and Santan found she still had the tiller in her hands. She began to paddle with it, pushing the raft towards the beach. She sobbed with each stroke, and her vision was blurred. Through her tears, she saw the kelp bed swaying and dancing at the edge of the ocean, and beyond them the surf humping up and then hissing over a beach of brassy yellow sands. She paddled in a dedicated frenzy, and an eddy of the current caught the raft, assisting her efforts, and bore it in towards the beach. Now she could see the bottom, the corrugated patterns of sea-washed sands through the limpid green water.
"Thank you, God. Oh, thank you. Thank you," she sobbed in time to her strokes.
And then again there came that shattering impact of a huge body into the underside of the raft. Santan clung desperately to the strut again, her spirits plunging with despair.
"It's come back again."
She saw the massive, dappled shape pass beneath the raft, starkly outlined against the gleaming sandy bottom.
"It never gives up."
She had one only temporary respite. The shark had devoured the sacrifice she had offered it within minutes. Then, drawn by the odour of the blood that was still spattered over the raft, it had followed her into water barely as deep as a man's shoulder. It came around in a wide circle and then raced in from the seaside to attack the raft again. And this time the impact was so shattering that the raft began to break up. The planks had been worked loose by the heavy flogging of the storm, and they opened now under Santan so her legs dropped through and she touched the horrid beast beneath the raft. She felt the rasping of its coarse hide across the soft skin of her calf and screamed as she jackknifed her lower body up away from it. Inexorably, the shark circled and came back, but the slope of the beach forced it to come from the seaside, and its next attack, murderous as it was, drove the raft even closer to the beach, and for a moment or two the colossal beast was stranded on the shelving sand. Then, with a swirl and a high splash, it pulled free and circled out into deeper water, but with its fin and broad blue back exposed. A wave hit the raft, completing the demolition that the shark had begun, and the raft shattered into a welter of planks and canvas and dangling ropes. Santan was tumbled into the surging waters, and spluttering and coughing came to her feet. She was breast deep in the cold green surf, and through eyes streaming with salt water, she saw the shark come boring full at her. She screamed and tried to back up. The shelving beach, brandishing the tiller she still had in her hands,
"Get away!" she screamed. "Get away! Leave me!"
The shark hit her with his snout and threw her high in the air. She fell back on top of the huge blue back, and it reared under her like a wild horse. The feel of it was cold and rough and unspeakably loathsome. She was thrown clear of it and then was struck a heavy blow by the flailing tail. She knew it had been a glancing blow. A full sweep of that tail would have crushed in her ribcage. The shark's own wild thrashing had churned up the sandy bottom, blinding it so that it could not see its prey, but it sought her with its mouth in the turbid water. The jaws champed like an iron gate slamming in a hurricane, and Santan was beaten and hammered by the swinging tail and the massive contortions of the blue body. Slowly, she fought her way up the sloping beach. Every time she was knocked down, she struggled up, gasping and blinded and striking out with the tiller. The gnashing fangs closed on the thick folds of her skirt and ripped them away, and immediately her legs were freed. As she stumbled back a last few paces, the level of the water fell below her waist. At the same moment, the surf drew back, sucking away from the beach, and the shark was stranded, suddenly powerless as it was deprived of its natural element. It wriggled and writhed on the sand, helpless as a bull elephant in a pitfall, and Santan backed away from it, knee-deep in the dragging surf, too exhausted to turn and run, until, miraculously, she realized that she was standing on hard-packed sand above the waterline. She threw the tiller aside and staggered up the beach towards the high dunes. She did not have the strength to go that far. She collapsed just above the high waterline and lay face down in the sand. The sand coated her face and body like sugar, and she lay in the sunlight and wept with the fierce gales of fear and sorrow and remorse and relief that racked her entire body. She had no idea how long she lay in the sand, but after a while she became aware of the sting of the harsh sunlight on the backs of her bare legs, and she sat up slowly. Fearfully she looked back to the edge of the surf, expecting still to see the great blue beast stranded there, but the flooding tide must have lifted it, and it had escaped out into deep water. There was no sign of it at all. She let out her breath in an involuntary gasp of relief and stood up, uncertainly. Her body felt battered and crushed and very weak, and looking down at it she saw how contact with the rough, abrasive hide of the shark had grazed her skin raw, and that already there were dark blue bruises spreading across her thighs. Her skirts had been torn off her by the shark, and she had discarded her shoes before she jumped from the deck of the hospital ship, so except for her sodden uniform blouse and a pair of silk cami knickers, she was naked. She felt a rush of shame and looked around her quickly. She had never been further from other human presence in her life. "No one to peek at me here." She had instinctively covered her pudenda with her hands, and she let them fall to her sides again, and she touched something hanging from her waist. It was Ernie's clasp knife, dangling on its lanyard. She took it in her hand and stared out over the ocean. All her guilt and remorse returned to her with a rush. "I owe you my life," she whispered, "and the life of my son. Oh, Ernie, how I wish you were still with us." The loneliness came upon her with such an overpowering rush that she sagged down onto the sand again and covered her face with her hands. The sun roused her once again. She felt her skin beginning to prickle and burn again under its baleful rays, and immediately her thirst returned to nag at her. "Must protect myself from the sun." She dragged herself upright and looked around her with more attention. She was on a wide yellow beach backed by mountainous dunes. The beach was totally deserted. It stretched away in sweeping curves on each side of her to the very limit of her vision. 20 or 30 kilometres, she estimated, before it shaded into the sea fret. It seemed to Santen to be the picture of desolation. There was no rock or leaf or vegetation, no bird or animal, and no cover from the sun. Then she looked at the edge of the beach where she had struggled ashore, and she saw the remnants of her raft swirling and tumbling in the surf. Fighting down her terror of the shark, she waded in knee-deep and dragged the tangled sail and sheets of the raft high above the tide line. For a skirt, she cut a strip of canvas and belted it around her waist with a length of hemp rope. Then she cut another piece of canvas to cover her head and shoulders from the sun. "Oh, I'm so thirsty." She stood at the edge of the beach and longingly peered out to where the kelp beds danced in the current. Her thirst was more powerful than her distaste for the kelp juice, but her terror of the shark was greater than both, and she turned away. Though her body ached and the bruises were purple and black across her arms and legs, she knew that her best chance was to start walking, and there was only one direction to take. Cape Town lay to the south. However, nearer than that were the German towns with strange names. She recalled them with an effort, Swakopmund and Luderitzbucht. The nearest of these was probably 500 kilometres away. 500 kilometres. The enormity of that distance came over her, and her legs turned to water under her and she sat down heavily on the sand.
"I won't think about how far it is."
She roused herself at last.
"I will think only one step ahead at a time."
She pulled herself to her feet, and her whole body ached with bruises. She began to limp along the edge of the sea, where the sand was wet and firm, and after a while her muscles warmed and the stiffness eased so she could extend her stride.
"Just one step at a time," she told herself.
The loneliness was a burden that would weigh her down if she let it. She lifted her chin and looked ahead. The beach was endless, and there was a frightening sameness to the vista that stretched before her. The hours that she trudged on seemed to have no effect upon it, and she began to believe that she was on a treadmill, with always the unbroken sands ahead of her. The changeless sea on her right hand, the tall wall of the dunes on her left, and over it all, the vast, milky blue bowl of the sky.
"I am walking from nothingness on to nothing," she whispered,
and she longed with all her soul for the glimpse of another human form. The soles of her bare feet began to hurt, and when she sat down to examine them, she found that seawater had softened her skin, and the coarse yellow sand had abraded it almost down to the flesh. She bound up her feet with strips of canvas and went on. The sun and the exertion dampened her blouse with sweat, and thirst became her constant, spectral companion. The sun was halfway down the western sky when in the distance, ahead of her, a rocky headland appeared, and merely because it altered the dreary vista, she quickened her pace. But her step soon faltered again when she realized how the single day's trek had already weakened her.
"I haven't eaten for 3 days, and I haven't drunk since yesterday."
The rocky headland seemed to come no nearer, and at last she had to sit down to rest, and almost immediately her thirst began to rage.
"If I don't drink very soon, I won't be able to go on," she whispered,
and she peered ahead at the low rampart of black rock and straightened up incredulously. Her eyes were tricking her. She blinked them rapidly and stared again.
"People,"
she whispered, and pulled herself to her feet.
"People!"
She began to stagger forward. They were sitting on the rocks. She could see the movement of their heads silhouetted against the pale sky, and she laughed aloud and waved to them.
"There are so many. Am I going mad?"
She tried to shout, but it came out as a reedy little whine. Disappointment, when it struck, was so intense that she reeled as though from a physical blow.
"Seals,"
she whispered, and their mournful honking cries carried to her on the soft sea breeze. For a while she did not think that she had the strength to go on, and then she forced one foot in front of the other and plodded on towards the headland. Several hundred seals were draped over the rocks, and there were many more bobbing about in the waves that broke over the rocky point, and the stench of them came to Santan on the wind. As she approached, they began to retreat towards the sea, flopping over the rocks in their ludicrously clownish way, and she saw that there were dozens of calves amongst them.
"If I could only catch one of those."
She gripped the clasp knife in her right hand and opened the blade.
"I have to eat soon."
But already alarmed by her approach, the leaders were sliding from the rocks into the surging green water, their ungainly lumberings transformed instantly into miraculous grace. She started to run, and the movement precipitated a rush of dark bodies over the rocks. She was still 100 yards from the nearest of them. She gave up and stood, panting weakly, watching the colony escape into the sea. Then suddenly there was a wild commotion amongst them, a chorus of squeals and terrified cries, and she saw two dark, agile, wolf-like shapes dart from amongst the rocks and drive into the densely packed troop of seals. She realized that her approach had distracted the colony, and given these other predators a chance to launch their own attack. She did not recognize them as brown hyena, for she had only seen illustrations of the bigger and more ferocious spotted hyena which almost every book on Africa exploration contained. These animals were the beach wolf of the Dutch settlers, the size of a mastiff, but with sharp, pointed ears and a shaggy mane of long, ashy yellow fur that was now erect in excitation as they dashed into the colony of seals. Unerringly, they picked out the smallest and most defenceless of the infants, seizing them from the flanks of their cumbersome dams, and dragged them away, easily avoiding the grotesque efforts that the mothers made to defend their young. Santan began running again, and at her approach the female seals gave up and flopped down the black rocks into the surf. She snatched up a club of driftwood from the pile of rubbish on the high tide mark, and raced across the end of the headland to cut off the nearest of the brown hyena. The hyena was hampered by the squealing baby seal that it was dragging, and Santan managed to get ahead of it. The animal stopped and lowered its head in a threatening stance and watched Santan approaching. The young seal was bleeding copiously from where the hyena's fangs were locked into its glossy pelt, and it was crying like a human infant. The hyena growled fiercely, and Santan stopped, facing the beast, and swung the club and shrieked at it. "Drop it! Get away, you brute! Leave it!" She sensed that the hyena was perplexed by her aggressive attitude, and though it growled again, it backed up a few steps and crouched protectively over its wriggling prey. Santan tried to stare it down, holding the gaze of the formidable yellow eyes as she shouted and brandished the club. Abruptly, the hyena dropped the badly injured seal cub and rushed directly at Santan, baring long yellow fangs and making a roaring bellow in its throat. Instinctively, Santan knew that this was the crucial moment. If she ran, the hyena would follow her and savage her. She rushed forward to meet the animal's charge, redoubling her yells and swinging the club with all her strength. Evidently, the hyena had not expected this reaction. Its courage failed. It turned and ran back to its floundering prey, and burying its fangs in the silky skin of its neck, began to drag it away again. At Santan's feet was a crevice in the rocks, and it was filled with water-worn round stones. She grabbed one of these, the size of a ripe orange, and hurled it at the hyena. She aimed for the head, but the heavy stone fell short, and it hit the creature's paw, crushing it against the rocky ground. The hyena squealed, dropped the seal cub, and limped swiftly away on three legs. Santan ran forward and opened the clasp knife. She was a country girl and had helped Anna and her father slaughter and dress animals before. With a single, swift, merciful stroke, she cut the seal's throat and let it bleed. The hyena circled back, growling and whining, limping heavily, undecided and confused by the attack. Santan snatched up stones from the crevice in both hands and threw them. One of them struck the hyena on the side of its bushy-maned head, and it yelped and fled 50 paces before stopping and staring back at her over its shoulder with hatred. She worked swiftly. As she had watched Anna do so often with a sheep's carcass, she slit open the belly cavity, angling the point of the blade, so as not to nick the stomach sac or the entrails, sawing through the cartilage that closed the front of the ribcage. With bloodied hands, she hurled another stone at the circling hyena, and then carefully lifted out the infant seal's stomach. The need for moisture was a raging fever within her. Already she sensed that lack of it was threatening the existence of the embryo in her own womb. And yet her gorge rose at the thought of what she must do. "When I was a girl," Anna had told her, "the shepherds used to do it whenever a suckling lamb died." Santan held the seal cub's little stomach bag in her cupped and bloodied hands. The stomach lining was yellowish and translucent, so that she fancies that she could see the contents through the walls. The cub must obviously have been lying with its mother up to the moment of the hyena attack, and it must have been suckling greedily. The small stomach was drummed tight with milk. Santan gulped with revulsion and then told herself, "If you don't drink, you'll be dead by morning, you and Michel's son both." She made a tiny incision in the stomach wall, and immediately the thick white curds of milk oozed from it. Santan closed her eyes and placed her mouth over the slit. She forced herself to suck the hot, curdled milk. Her empty stomach heaved, and she choked with an involuntary retching reflex, but she fought and at last controlled it. The curds had a slightly fishy taste, but were not altogether repulsive. After she had forced down the first mouthful, she thought it tasted a little of the goat's milk cheese that Anna made, strong with rennet. She rested after a while and wiped the blood and mucus from her mouth with the back of her hand. She could almost feel the fluid soaking back to replace that lost by her body tissues, and new strength seemed to radiate through her exhausted body. She hurled another rock at the hyena, and then drank the rest of the thick, curdled milk. Carefully, she slit open the tiny, empty stomach sac and licked up the last drops. Then she threw the empty membrane to the hyena. "I will share it with you," she told the snarling beast. She skinned the carcass, cutting off the head and the rudimentary limbs, and threw those to the hyena also. The big dog-like carnivore seemed to have resigned itself. It sat on its haunches 20 paces from Santen, with its pointed ears pricked up, and a comically expectant expression, waiting for the scraps she threw it. Santen cut as many long, narrow strips of the bright red seal meat as she could get off the skeleton, and wrapped them in the canvas of her headdress. Then she retreated, and the hyena rushed forward to lick up the spilled blood from the rocks and to crush the small skeleton in its ugly, overdeveloped jaws. At the top of the headland, the wind and wave action had cut a shallow overhang from the compacted sandstone, and it had provided a shelter for others before Santen. She found the scattered ashes of a long, dead cooking fire on the sandy floor of the cave, and when she scratched in the dirt, she turned up a small triangular flint scraper or cutting tool, similar to those for which she and Anna had hunted on the hillock behind the chateau at Mortom. It gave her a peculiarly nostalgic pang to hold the scrap of flint in the grubby palm of her hand, and when she felt self-pity overcoming her, she placed the sliver of stone in the pocket of her blouse, and forced herself to face harsh reality rather than mope over bygone days in a far-off land. "Fire," she said, as she examined the dead sticks of charcoal, and she laid out the precious scraps of seal meat on a rock at the mouth of the cave, to dry in the wind, and went back to gather an armful of driftwood. She piled this beside the ancient hearth and tried to remember everything she had ever read about making fire. "Two sticks, rub them together," she muttered. It was a human need so basic, so taken for granted in her life until then, that now the lack of fire with its warmth and comfort was an appalling deprivation. The driftwood was impregnated with salt and damp. She selected 2 pieces, not having the vaguest notion of the qualities of the wood she required, and she set about experimenting. She worked until her fingers were raw and hurting, but she could not induce a single spark or even a wisp of smoke from her scraps of wood shavings. Depressed and despondent, she lay back against the rear wall of the rock shelter and watched the sun set into the darkening sea. She shivered with the chill of the evening breeze and wrapped the canvas shawl more securely around her shoulders. She felt the small lump of flint press into her breast. She noticed how tender her nipples had become recently and how her breasts had begun to swell and harden, and she massaged them now. Somehow the thought of her pregnancy gave her renewed strength, and when she looked southwards, she saw Michelle's special star hanging low on the horizon, where a somber ocean was blending into the night sky.
"Achenar," she whispered. "Michelle."
And as she said his name, her fingers touched the flint in her pocket again. It was almost as though it was Michelle's gift to her, and her hand shook with excitement as she struck the flint against the steel blade of the clasp knife, and the white sparks flared in the darkness of the rocky shelter. She worried the threads of canvas into a loose ball, mixed with fine wood shavings, and struck flint and steel over it. Although each attempt produced a shower of bright white sparks, it took all her care and persistence before at last a wisp of smoke rose from the ball of kindling, and she blew it into a tiny yellow flame. She grilled the strips of seal meat over the coals. They tasted like both veal and rabbit. She savoured each bite, and after she had eaten, she anointed the painful red blisters that the sun had raised on her skin with seal fat. She set aside the remaining strips of cooked meat for the days ahead, built up the fire, wrapped the canvas around her shoulders, and settled herself against the near wall of the shelter and the club beside her. "I should pray." And as she began, Anna seemed very close, watching over her as she had so often before, when Xantenne, the child, knelt beside her bed with hands clasped before her. "Thank you, Almighty God, for saving me from the sea, and thank you for the food and drink you have provided, but..." The prayer petered out, and Xantenne felt recriminations rather than gratitude pressing to her lips. "Blasphemy!" She almost heard Anna's voice, and she ended the prayer hastily. "And, O Lord, please give me the strength to face whatever further trials you have in store for me in the days ahead, and if it please you, give me also the wisdom to see your design and purpose in heaping these tribulations upon me." That was as much of a protest as she would risk, and while she was still trying to decide on a suitable ending for the prayer, she fell asleep. When she awoke, the fire had died down to embers, and she did not at first know where she was or what had woken her. Then her circumstances came back to her with a sickening rush, and she heard some large animal out in the darkness just beyond the opening of the shelter. It sounded as though it was feeding. Quickly she piled driftwood on the fire and blew up a flame. At the edge of the firelight, she saw the lurking shape of the hyena, and she realized that the package of cooked seal meat that she had so carefully wrapped in a strip of canvas the previous evening was gone from the rock beside the fire. Sobbing with rage and frustration, she picked up a flaming brand and hurled it at the hyena. "You horrible thieving brute!" she screamed, and it yelped and galloped away into the darkness.